Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest Empire Podcast interview special. It's not February 2nd, it's June 8th as I record this, but it is very much Groundhog Day, folks. 30 years ago, Harold Ramis and Bill Murray came together to make Groundhog Day, a film about a venal and selfish weatherman who relives the same day over and over again before eventually emerging a better person on the other side. A hit at the time, it has since become a stone-cold classic over the years, with people flocking back to it for its timeless vibes, big warm heart, easy humour, and for the many, many ways of interpreting Phil Connors' spell in time prison in any number of interesting and creative ways. The concept and the initial screenplay was the brainchild of Danny Rubin, who documents the process brilliantly in his must-read book on screenwriting, How to Write Groundhog Day. He's been following his own advice since, because in 2016, he wrote the book for a musical adaptation of Groundhog Day that debuted at the Old Vic in London. Perhaps something about being able to change and perfect a work of art over time appealed to him. That show was directed by Matthew Warchus, with music and lyrics from Tim Minchin, the creative team behind the smash hit musical version of Matilda. And if you've listened to the Empire podcast over the last 5 years or so, chances are you'll have heard me wax lyrical about Groundhog Day the musical, because it was fantastic, playful and profound, with incredibly inventive staging and wonderful songs that shone the spotlight on characters other than Phil Connors, although he was brought to life brilliantly by American actor Andy Carl in a performance that nabbed him an Olivier Award and, incredibly, banished all memories of Bill Murray. Why am I telling you all this? Well, because now Groundhog Day the musical is back for its long-promised revival, playing for the next few months at the Old Vic in London, and I strongly urge you to try and get a ticket if you can. But don't worry if you can't, because as you're about to hear, there are plans for a tour, a potential London residency, and much, much more. That's because, as a big fan of the musical and the movie, of course, when I heard it was being revived, I jumped at the chance to do a podcast about it, which is how, last week, I found myself in Matthew Warchus's office at the Old Vic, talking to him, Tim Minchin, and Danny Rubin for almost an hour, talking about everything from the project's genesis to the challenges of doing it all again with Andy Carl once more, from Groundhog Day's eternal themes, and to the creation of individual songs that I adore. The trio also spoke very candidly about the show's failure on Broadway in 2017, where, despite glowing reviews and 7 Tony nominations, it closed after just a few months. Another reason why this revival feels so important, in a way, this creative team is getting another shot and a chance to not end the story of Groundhog Day the musical on a bum note. How thematically apt. So a couple of quick things before we begin. This conversation is primarily about Groundhog Day the musical, but we do touch on the film from time to time, of course. So this interview may be a bit niche if you haven't seen the musical, but I would still recommend that you listen, because it is a funny, insightful and fascinating conversation about creativity with 3 guys who are among the best in the business at doing so. And if you do know and love the musical as I do, then this is right up your alley. Oh, and I was recording myself on my phone. All the microphones were in use by the 3 guys. So there are a couple of moments here where I've re-recorded a line because of poor sound quality. It was also a warm day, so the window was open, and now and again sounds from outside would leak through. Hopefully nothing too bad. So without any further ado, here's Danny Rubin, Tim Minchin, and Matthew Warchus at the Old Vic. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on this very special Groundhog Day podcast by Danny Rubin, Tim Minchin, and Matthew Warchus. Matthew, were you in your...
My office at the Old Vic.
The office, yes. At the Old Vic. That's amazing. Yeah. It's pretty nice. It's pretty nice.
Thank you.
It beats mine by some considerable distance. How does it feel, guys, to be back? I guess this is the Groundhog Day vacation of this musical. You get a second bite at the cherry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, 2 seems like a good start.
Yeah. Well, who knows? This might be day 10,000 for all we
know.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's exciting. It's, you know, it's one of those things we can genuinely say it's backed by popular demand, because we were turning people away the first time it played at the Old Vic. And it's something that we really wanted to find a way to bring back and set it up in a way that it was a production that could play other places as well. The original production of this was built on 5 revolving
automated
automated
turntables,
which was untourable and very time consuming. And so part of the project for me was to bring back everything we loved about the show, but to stage it in a way which didn't require turntables.
Has that
It's one
come
of those
off?
Sad things from a directing point of view that having spent 300 hours programming Revolves last time, it turns
and
out that
$3 million.
They're completely unnecessary.
How did you tackle it this time? Just get the actors to revolve for like Star Trek?
It's interesting. It's we're just taking a slightly different approach to the staging. I say interesting, it's of no interest to anybody other than me. But, you know, somebody once said that, to me, you're doing a musical of Groundhog Day. Isn't that just the same song over and over again? And of course, when you actually start looking at the story, it's not actually about repeats, it's about the differences every time. And this, the idea that we would revolve and come around to the same place, that's not at all what's required. It's a process and a progress through a story.
Mm-hmm. And
this is how you're going to feel at the end of your career. You're going to retire at 70 and go, oh, theatre, that's actually not necessary. Should spend it on hospitals.
And Tim, from your point of view, second time around, did you make many tweaks to the songs?
It was a really good opportunity to just fiddle with some things that had annoyed me a bit, to just adjust the orchestrations a bit, and partly because 6 years is a long time, so just your aesthetic changes a bit or something. And I think, I don't know, for me it's the same aim as everyone here. We wanted the show to be a tiny bit lighter on its feet. We built it for Broadway because that's where all the investors, you know, that was the intention from day one, to take it to Broadway. And when you take something to Broadway, you sort of have to pimp the hell out of it because that's what they expect, all the bells and whistles. And
we razzle dazzle.
This is actually more, you know, to Matthew's point, if anything, this production, which is a slightly smaller cast and a slightly smaller pit and slightly more push-pull, as we say, you know, the scenery is sort of moved by the actors instead of by robots. It actually supports the themes of the show, this sort of idea that to live a meaningful life, you have to be part of something and,
you have to be
and
present,
contribute
yeah.
to collectivity or collectiveness or something. So it feels really, really right. That said, I haven't seen it yet. I left a month ago, the day of the first run through with this cast. I wasn't here for Sitz Probe when the band comes in, and I haven't seen all Matthew's new staging.
We've automated most of it now.
Yeah. So I'm seeing it tonight. So I'm very excited, actually, and a little bit scared.
What happens? What happens if you don't like it, Tim? What happens?
I guess
what do you do?
I've actually gone through that in my head. I was like, what if I just hate it? Like, what if I just, and I thought I'd just cry and go home. Like, no, I'm really, really excited. I do. The other thing about this musical is that when you make stuff, I've always, and I think Matthew's the same, Danny's profoundly the same, perhaps more than both of us, you make stuff that you're interested in. It's very easy in this industry to sort of try and second guess your audience and try and find a hole in the market. And like, I'm going to make some work a bit like that last six, like I'm going to go write a TV show that's a bit like Succession, because obviously people like that stuff, whatever, that reactive market driven art. And no one here is very, I don't think we're very good at that.
Mm.
The upside of that is whatever happens to a piece of work, if you love what you made, it's quite gratifying, and I love this musical. I think it's cool. Cool as fuck.
It is absolutely cool as fuck. And Danny, this is, I don't know how many bites of the cherry you've had now with Groundhog Day, from film to book.
You don't bite apples here? Cherries are so small.
Your cherries might be.
Whatever you want to bite. You can bite it as many times as you want.
But, thank you.
Yeah. Have you, again, tweaked and finessed anything from the previous staging, or is this...
Just to accommodate the minor downsizing we did with the restaging, I think Tim will be delighted to see that the show feels the same. And, I think that's mostly to Matthew's credit, from casting to just rethinking it, that it feels like the same show, and yet even stronger because just with minor rephrasing, able to to really reveal things that were already in the lyrics and were already in the dialogue. So, you know, I'm just psyched to be here. And also, ever since it closed on Broadway, my mother has been waiting for it to reopen. And I think she's holding on to that, like in the story, The Last Leaf. So I keep saying, yeah, next year it'll go up, Mom. Anyway, so this could be the end for
you. Doomed your mother.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry about that. We waited about as long as we could.
And so how old is she, Danny?
90.
Yeah, and she's coming.
She'll be here on Friday, yeah, God wonderful. Willing.
It's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
That's amazing. You've mentioned Broadway there a couple of times. And, you know, when I saw the show, the Old Vic, when it first opened, I loved it. I just fell head over heels for it. I was evangelical about it, as people who listen to this podcast regularly will know, because even on a film podcast, I talk about how great Groundhog Day the musical is constantly. But Broadway obviously must have been a huge disappointment for you all. What?
Not at all.
No?
I loved it. Yeah? I just had the best time. If they were providing the entire thing just for my entertainment, they did a great job. and when it closed after 5 months, I was like, oh, 5 months, that's pretty good. I was on Broadway.
I
saw some amazing people do some great work, and I really enjoyed it with some big audiences. I saw how disappointed everyone else was, but I kind of felt like I'd had a great adventure.
Yeah, Danny's a better person than us. He's considerably more Buddhist. I mean, on a scale of not at all Buddhist to very Buddhist, we're all closer to the first bit, but Danny's definitely further up than us.
I think also what is true is that we had almost unbeatable reviews. So it depends what you're sort of investing in. So you know, on one level, you're investing in just a personal creative experience and expressing that side of yourself. And we all managed to do that. Yeah. We got it.
Yeah.
And I think we were proud of that version as we are this version of the show. On the other side, there is a critical reception, which you try not to invest in too much, because if you're relatively thin-skinned like I am, you can get hurt by investing in that. However, we didn't get hurt. We got really rapturous reception on Broadway, critically speaking. And then there's, you know, the audience. And there's two things about connecting with an audience. One is that you just see people receiving a story and benefiting from it, or loving it as much as you do, or being affected by it emotionally anyway. And that happened as well. We got great audiences, and they went through the emotional ride that we intended and that we aspired to. So really it comes down to the business side of it, which didn't work. And we didn't get enough audiences for a long enough time because of various, this conjecture about that season being overcrowded with musicals, and many shows died off quickly. And so on that side of things, it was a business failure. But you set that against the success, even triumph on other sides that we experienced. And it was definitely a mixed feeling in the end.
I'm a bit like Matthew. I want everyone to love it, and I want it to be known that it's loved. And one of the hard things is that Broadway, like Hollywood, is reductive. And, you know, even the phrase a hit, it's very American because it implies a miss. And what they mean by a hit is it made everyone money. And but if that implies a miss, is it didn't make everyone money, then you know you're just on a completely different scale of what is valuable. That said, we are in that business. We're not making, you know, if all we cared about is the art, I guess we could make a little amateur production and put it on and be proud of it and move on. We have chosen in our different ways to swim in those sort of scary waters where stuff does sink and people do get hurt and people gamble, and it's kind of brutal because it's big business and business is brutal. And so you want to win because it feels sad to not. But As I said earlier, I think what's fantastic is if you compromise what you think is good in order to try and achieve a market share.
Yeah.
And it doesn't achieve a market share, then you've both made something you knew was crap and it's been proven to be not popular. I'd much rather make something that I think is good and have it proven not popular. As it happens, that wasn't that wasn't the story in this case. And we've always known that it has a future life. What's been really interesting is the hurdles to getting it back to London that include global pandemics and the loss of our friend who was the producer and, you know, all sorts of machinations of the politics of the theatres and stuff. And it just took a long time. But right now it feels like the time's concertinaed and we're back, and who cares that it's been 6 years? It's back and it's better than ever, apparently.
You'll see tonight, Tim.
Yeah,
but was it also important then, in terms of coming back, that Andy was part of this? That you got Andy to play Phil Connors?
Now there's a dime a dozen, those guys.
Yeah. Well, you remember, he gives an absolutely extraordinary performance. And so when he expressed an interest in coming back, I was delighted. That was a no-brainer. And he can do everything. It's in a way, because it's a new musical, it's true to say that the show's been built on him, which poses a bit of a problem going forward, because the number of people that can do everything that he can do, and I mean the acting performance, the sense of comedy, the clowning, the sense of being able to perform a repellent character with charm, the choreography, the dancing, you know, all that physicality as well. He just throws himself at it and nails it on every level. So in the future, when, you know, he's done enough of the show and other people are playing Phil, he set a very high bar. But what a lovely guy as well, a great leader of a company, great fun to have around. So we're delighted to have him back.
It'll be very fun to cast Phil in the future. I mean, it will be hard because he is outstanding, but certainly Matthew and I have learnt through Matilda, when we first found those first four girls, I had nothing to do with it, and Matthew and the casting people found those first four girls, we thought, oh my God, there's four miracles. And what are we going to do? How many have there been now? 130? Or?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's just in the productions we've been involved in. I mean, around the world, you know, there are extraordinary people out there. And when, you know, the Matildas who are Matilda now, they were born after Matilda opened on the West End.
Mm.
And they grew up knowing with their two short parents and their beautiful voices that maybe one day they could be Matilda. So they actually, some of those kids have been aspiring to that role for as long as they can remember. And there's no doubt that this musical, I think, because of its complexity and that people who love theatre love this musical because it's so rich in all the stuff that we love if we love theatre. I think there will be people out there right now thinking, I'm gonna get my chops up because when that goes on tour, I'm gonna audition, you know. So people will aspire to it, and I'm really looking forward to different interpretations.
Is that the plan, that you're gonna go on tour, or maybe a residency in London somewhere other than the Old Vic?
Yeah, I mean, you know, experience tells you not to plan, so I wouldn't say there's a plan. There's an opportunity for sure.
Yeah,
and it'll be dictated by the popularity of the show, inevitably, as things always are. But that would be a great version of what happens next, an extended run in London, a tour, productions in other countries. And you
certainly
know,
some very keen Australian producers jumping
right
at the bit.
Yeah, I think that there are territories that are very eager to see the show, and we've now created a production where it's possible to bring it to them. So we'll see.
Amazing. And Danny, is your plan then, you know, you had a great time at Broadway, is your plan to just travel the world with this production?
It could be.
I mean, just you and your mum for the next 30 years.
She might need somebody helping her along. I wouldn't mind being that person. Well, why not? It's nice to have an excuse to travel and go different places and meet wonderful people. So it could happen.
Absolutely. Let's take you right back to the beginning, Danny, of this musical. You know, when did it first come to life for you? Did it start with you, or did it start with Matthew and Tim? How did it come about?
That's true. It started with all of us independently, and I'm glad we found each other. I had been hoping to make it into a musical and working on it for many years in the background, sort of half getting my feet into, you know, musical stage theater, which I'm familiar with but don't really know. and trying to figure out whether I could actually be the writer or whether my being the writer would doom the project completely. And I talked to enough people to decide, yeah, I could do this. And then I met these fellows and they were very excited about it. And I was so taken by Matilda. I wanted to know more about how they would do this. And, you know, I just loved the honesty of the collaboration and the sincerity of their wanting to do great work and not just commercial work, which was always my goal as well.
And Tim and Matthew, from your point of view, when Danny first has a conversation about this with you, what's the light bulb moment for you both?
Well, Groundhog Day is a film that I really loved and used to watch from time to time when it was on television. It always used to make me laugh a lot and invariably it used to make me cry. And it just came into my mind after we'd done Matilda that there was the kind of mashup of cleverness and emotion that is, I just thought Tim, it's got Tim's signature all over it as a concept. It's got a kind of mathematical side to it. It's got a satirical side to it. It deals with big issues about life and it's got a very, very silly and absurdist and outrageous humor about it as well. And so I said to Tim, how about after Matilda, us looking at Groundhog Day? And I think you pretty quickly you saw some of the same things that I saw. And I went pursuing the right situation. I didn't know anything about it. And it led me to Sony and Columbia and to Danny. And I can't remember where we had our first meeting or I can't remember the very first time we spoke.
Wow, it was memorable to me. I guess I was just another blur of the parade of people going past you, Matthew.
But I know we met in London. You came up to London to see Matilda, I think, or we met in New York as well. I don't know. We had several meetings. And in the end, I said, look, you don't have to decide right now, I said to both the studio and to Danny. I said, just let us start and let's see how it goes. And so we actually, I don't know if you realize, we completed the musical, the writing, you guys,
the writing of it,
before we had the rights. But we knew that nobody else was going to get the rights. We'd been given that promise. And so it was a very upside down way of doing it. But the way we made it was emblematic of the thing that made it work, actually, which is trust and collaboration and a sense of artistic endeavor rather than business.
That is a heck of a leap. That's a heck of a leap.
Yeah, I still do a bit of that nonsense. I think I get so complicated, as you know, with some success comes a lot of contracts and stuff, and the contracts get complicated, and I still sometimes say, and have very recently with that song I sent you the other day, that it's a big job and they were like, you know, would you consider us commissioning you to write a song? And I tend to say, no, I'll write you one. And if you want it, then you can pay me, you know, good money for it. But I'm not going to be contracted to write a song and you come back with seven different the reason I do that is because I think it can just clarify the intention. I think it's the same as what we did with Groundhog Day. If you really care about something and believe in that you're the right person, then write it. And, you know, don't spend all that time and money trying to do a contract that locks everyone in. Just write it and then everyone will be happy and then we'll do a contract then. I mean, it's stupid advice, but I do it.
So where did you start with the music?
Well, it's all about mapping. And so Danny and Matthew and Chris Nightingale, the music supervisor, who's the orchestrator and writer of a lot of the music, actually, in this show, and me, that everyone that was in the room, really, initially. Mm-hmm. And we just sat down and got hold of a shooting script, like the last script that Danny was happy with, or at least the script that Danny was happy for us to kind of work off as a source material, which was quite a late shooting script, but certainly not the final. It didn't represent exactly the movie, because a movie, of course, is built in edit. So, and then it's about, for me, it's about sticky notes with color-coded sticky notes in rows, and going, so this is, these are the scenes. If you break this down into beats, these are the beats of the story, and this is where there could be a song, and this is the sort of song it might. It could be a chorus number to open, and then we want to hear from Phil, and you know, and whatever. That's a really fun, really hard, complex, wonderful, long process. Long before, you know, and maybe I'm popping home to go, okay, what would the tone be? And, you know, having my stupid idea that it should be a sort of swing noir thing initially. I don't know
why I thought that. but I think
it was hard. It was a very unusual challenge because of the structure of the show, because the first thing you have to do is set up the premise that this guy is going to live the same day over and over again, which it's just hard, much harder on stage than film, and much harder in a musical than just on stage. And we could do a 2-hour podcast about that, just talking about those challenges, couldn't we? But it's all about mapping, and we got a long way down the path of this is what the musical will look like. These are the songs. These are the subjects they're going to be before any music gets written.
Before you even write a note.
Yeah. Or did I come in early with something?
The thing that was very early on it was you, me, and Chris in a room, the piano, and you were talking about sunrise or something, and you played bum da da da.
Oh, that was,
da, da, da,
I forgot
da,
that. Was da, at, da, da, that was at Old Mate's place. That was at Ronnie Scott's.
Yeah.
We met at Ronnie Scott's, yeah. And I was coming
during the
in
day, not in the not in
the No, the daytime, because a friend of ours owns it. And I was walking in off the tube. I was living in England, wasn't I? And I thought, oh, I've got nothing. So I just went, oh, I guess I'll try and think of, I guess what I want is something that sounds infinite. So I just, in my head, between the tube and in a 5-minute period between the tube and Ronnie Scott's, came up with da 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 da. You know, this sense of like, it can just go forever. Perpetual circle. And I went in, and I, at some point halfway through the meeting, I said to Chris, I just came up with this sort of thing and I think it's crap. And Chris went, that's great. And that was that.
Yeah. And it had a feeling of rising quality and had a feeling of sunrise about it. And it had also had a very kind of American folk thing about it.
But it's epic. Yeah, it can be epic. Yeah.
And so that sort of contrast that's fundamental to the music in the show and to the show between the folksiness of the community, the story, the cuteness and the authenticity, if you like, of that, contrasting the edgy, angular, sometimes slightly dissonant, jazz-infused, urban sound for Phil.
Yeah.
That all led from, you know, to this opposition between small town and him having a big ego.
Yeah.
Also it's so built on the sort of central genius of Danny's idea, which is that it's a model for something epic. I mean, the idea that, you know, life starts with the dawn and ends with the night, and that, you know, humans have to find a way to be in themselves, and all these huge ideas, these, you know, depending on who you talk to, Buddhist ideas, but it could be ancient Greek or whatever, juxtaposed against this little town and these stupid little, like, it's so silly at about a groundhog, and like, and so that I wanted the music to do that. And certainly Chris's capacity with his orchestrations, you know, the whole musical starts with this incredibly complex jazzy thing to, which is sort of a little symbol of the chaos of life and of the complexity we're going to get to, but it lands on this and it's huge because it's saying in this small theater, we're going to do something, we're going to talk about life and death and big, you know, big, big themes, and then across the stage goes this little van, you know. And so from the very beginning, we're saying we get this as a joke, and also it's going to talk about the only things that matter in the whole universe, you know.
Yeah. And then imbuing each reprise of that, I guess, with a different feeling by the end, and seeing you when that song finishes, there's a beautiful feeling of warmth, of closure to it at the end.
Yeah.
And of course, that theme's just absolutely riddled throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
Hope is built on it. Even if I have my time again is the major version of it. And if anything, I lent on it a lot.
I think it is how it works.
What he's saying is he really only wrote one song.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. As it turns out.
Yeah, those people were right. It's the one song.
It's just one song.
And Danny, from your point of view, tackling this story again. I mean, obviously the screenplay for Groundhog Day underwent a number of iterations as well. And if anyone listening to this hasn't read Danny's book about writing Groundhog Day, you should pick it up immediately. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you.
And a wonderful guide to screenwriting. But tackling this again.
It wasn't a matter of tackling. I was so looking forward to it. It felt like the movie, which I love, of course, and I had a wonderful time with. The writer in Hollywood takes it so far, and then the director goes, okay, we got this. And they take it, and they've got their production to deal with, and the making of the movie is the writing of it in a way. And so I just, you know, was a bystander for the final, you know, final lap. And this gave me a chance, not only after 20 years or whatever of thinking about it and having people tell me what they thought about it, and watching it grow through the culture. I wanted to revisit all of the themes and be one of the finishers, be part of the team that is actually seeing it to the end, which was just such a pleasure for me. It felt like the completion of something that I had started long ago.
Also, you know, thinking about, you said how you've been thinking about making a musical of it before we turned up and other people had come to you. And I remember you had quite a lot of material that would be fed into the conversation that wasn't related to the screenplay either. I mean, several bits are very much in the production. One of them is this idea you had about a guy wandering around Punxsutawney dressed as a groundhog. And there being something sort of mysterious and supernatural and kind of, I don't know, fabled about that.
It's also whimsical. As
and
well.
That's definitely in the show, and kind of culminates in a great fun sequence in the second half. And there was more. I feel like with Danny, we had a kind of a spring, a fount of information and of understanding, and a depth of understanding of the characters, which was so brilliant. Tim and I could say to Danny, so we want to say more about Rita. All of us, you know, wanted to unpack Rita's character a bit more, which is obviously when characters sing, you get to know them much more intimately, potentially, or you get to hear more from them anyway. And so we were talking about Rita's character and digging a bit deeper into that. And of course, Danny kind of owns these characters or represents them in so many ways. And the story, when we would wonder if we could bend the story slightly more to the left or slightly more to the right or go down this little alleyway. And I remember somebody saying, yeah, there was something like that, actually, in the original draft.
Like we said, can you bring a screenplay? And he brought a screenplay and, like, some suitcases of notes of sort of expansive ideas down any alleyway. There was always more stuff. And sometimes there were bits, drafts came through of this that had... He said, oh, I had this idea, and the scene would be like, there was one scene that was like, Phil is floating in space or something. And I'm like, what? It's so fun. It was so good. And it was joyous.
I came in with a lot.
He came in with a lot. But it was just great.
And sort of like fractals or something where the closer you look, the more there is.
Yeah, totally.
And there was a thing, wasn't there, in the original idea of the story that Rita was also living in a loop, and then they woke up together on the last day, on the February the 3rd, they were both waking up from their own time loops, and it was fascinating hearing all of these extra little details and stuff, and they provoked you know, a huge amount of the tone or the detailed sensibility of what makes the stage musical different from the film. You know, these conversations informed all of that.
And giving Rita more to do and giving her more agency, that was very important to you.
Oh, absolutely. And that was taking advantage of the opportunity that we're doing it again, because the movie, I thought, did draw her as a kind of a contemporary working woman at a time where it was, I thought, important to have that character. But in order to make the movie, Harold Ramis was envisioning a fairy tale and was envisioning her as kind of the fairy tale princess. And though we know we wanted to do something with a little bit more substance, and I think it was Tim who kind of figured out how to turn it on its ear and say, okay, how does Rita think about the fairy tale and her relationship to that fairy tale? So it was really twisting the movie and doubling down on her character.
Yeah. And I think we always wanted to have our cake and eat it too. And I think one always can. I really believe in stories can do that. So you can, and often they fail to, but you can have a very complex character who is both one thing and the other. And then in our case, you can even have a silver slipper, as long as it's a white snow boot that's been given to her because her toes are numb, yes. not as some sign of ownership or wealth, you know. So you can always play with these things and twist them into saying something new without discarding the lovely structure of a love story. You know, you don't have to throw out the romance of two people inexorably drawn towards each other to deconstruct it. You can do both.
And it wasn't just Rita being given agency. We managed to give everybody a story.
Yeah.
And by doing that, kind of instructing the audience, oh, the first act, you were Phil. You were also seeing
two dimensions. It
as only as Phil's story, and everybody else was related to his story. And we say, oh, just as Phil learns that there are other people in the world with lives that he has some effect on that can also affect him, the audience gets to learn that lesson as well.
Absolutely. Is that part of the, is that partially why you start the musical with the townsfolk singing to broaden
that
out?
Yeah. It's that authentic kind of folksy anthem that they sing about tomorrow there will be sun. At the beginning, is to plant a degree of truth, and which will become part of Phil's destiny, really there, and also magic. You know, those the elders that are singing. They're called elders. These the people who lead the ceremony at Gobbler's Knob, and because of the antique nature of the ceremony, they're dressed in Victorian clothing and top hats and coats and. So you have a strange moment at the beginning where you don't know where you are in time or place, or whether you're in some magical and mysterious context as these people gather to greet the dawn. But in fact, it's preceded. It's not exactly how the show starts, because it's preceded by a front cloth moment of about 30 TV screens that are all carrying Phil's image. And of course, what that's about is how splitting a person into many, many different versions of themselves. So the image the audience gets initially when they come in is about a repeated version of Phil everywhere. And then they hear this beautifully sung and harmonized community song, really, before we spin off and make it all from Phil's point of view for a while.
Yeah. It's interesting because obviously I've seen the musical just once when it first came out, but I've listened to the soundtrack incessantly. And of course, it starts with you know, the overture, but it starts with that song as well. So in my head, that's how I remembered it from the beginning. But
when are you coming again?
I think next week. Next week, I'm hoping to come along. I'm very excited. Very excited. And this time, I don't think I'm going to be in the God seats. I was very, very high up last time.
Right. Well, I said there on Saturday, it was great up there.
Yeah, good.
I want to ask, I'll go let you guys go in a few minutes, but I want to ask about a couple of the songs in particular. Speaking of Rita, One Day is an amazing, amazing song and really gives us insight into her. Tim, from your point of view, was that a tough nut to crack, that song?
I don't really remember. I don't know how hard writing songs is. I think it's about getting the right idea. And so there's so many things we had to do with that song, because it was like a lot of the songs in this musical. The reason I'm so glad you listened to the album, but I find the album hard to listen to because it sort of doesn't make sense. It keeps cutting past scenes,
yeah.
And the songs are designed to be a framework that can support scenes within it. And especially One Day, which of course has the repeated attempts, the just horrible, lecherous attempts by Phil to sort of conquer Rita, which is when he's at his absolute worst and is what drives him towards crisis. And so I knew I wanted to play with the ideas of fairy tale tropes, this aspirational one day, you know, and the aspiration for me is always an octave jump because the greatest aspirational song in musical theatre ever written is Somewhere Over. So I had One Day, Someday. And so I just wanted to have that octave and I wanted to play with fairy tale tropes so we could, because there's so much meta stuff in this musical, so we could have the audience thinking about how much we as a culture are sort of defined by sort of storified versions of lives of narrative completeness and simplicity. And so it's doing all this, trying to do all this stuff. Mostly it's about getting her from being really annoyed at him going, I know you want donuts, and by which he means, I know you want me, and spending endless days trying to conquer her with this song that tells us all about Rita and her complex nature of both wanting the love story and not wanting to want the love story and sort of not wanting the love story. And then it has to drive towards an end where suddenly we open up the town and all their wants and how their wants are also complicated and how everyone's aspiring always to what they're going to do tomorrow. But actually there is only one day in Phil's world. And that of course poses this huge philosophical question about how do you genuinely live each day present and not aspiring and not regretting, just being present, which is where we get him to eventually. So there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on.
And, you know,
the whole podcast.
And interestingly, I remember a conversation when we were talking about, you know, sometimes it's, I think, maybe unhelpful, but sometimes it's helpful to imagine when you're looking at a story what some of the songs might be called or would be about. And I remember saying, you know, it would be great if there was a song that's called One Day in this, because obviously
it means,
that means two things. And what I was going to mean, Tim immediately grabbed the opportunity there for it to mean multiple things and to bring lots of different strands of the story together. And it's 17 minutes. That's the other thing.
Is it really?
It's a 17-minute song. It starts with I was brought up in Taffet addresses, and ends up with the Phil smashing the alarm clock and saying somebody make it stop, and covers so much ground in that. It's the end of Act One. Covers so much ground.
17 minutes
thematically in that 17 minutes.
Yeah, I'm very you know, necessity being the mother of invention. I mean, Miracle is also, at the beginning of Matilda, is a very unconventional start. It spans a bunch of scenes and goes for 12 minutes or something, doesn't it, in the stage musical.
Originally, it was longer than that. It was about 19 or something.
Oh, God. Because it sounds like that. But that, of course, is not the length of the song. It's the length of the period of the show that that song bridges. And One Day has sort of modular. It has a whole different bits. Of course, it gets to Joelle, you know, there was a day with a girl. And it just keeps coming back in on itself. And I don't know, because I don't really know enough about musical theatre canon, how common it is to use the form like this, but I'm not sure it is very common. I feel like it might be something we've slightly invented.
They're called, I call them umbrella songs because they arch over a multitude of scenes, you know, and events, and incorporate them in it. And somehow
songs
the song
often
fits.
Reprise at the,
yeah,
songs often function as, here's the song, we're going to do a whole lot of stuff and then we're going to reprise it. And in that way, it's sort of an umbrella. But that's not what we're doing.
No,
we're doing something a little bit more obnoxious.
At the beginning of that, it's at the beginning of the show as well. Small Town is the same thing. I haven't timed that one, but that's got to be, in a way, Small Town covers days 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, that's another very extended.
But it's got lots of bits in it.
Yeah.
I do think it's because of how difficult the task was. It did require a little bit of bespoke engineering of the form, which I love about it too. I mean, you know, it doesn't, whatever else you can say about it, it feels good to have made something genuinely its own thing. I always that is the most valuable thing for me to go, oh, well, it's ours. Whatever you say about it, it's ours. Very, very ours.
Where did the Ghostbusters 2 reference come from in that song?
It's me being cheeky.
Which begs the question, if Ghostbusters 2 exists in that world, who stars in that movie's in that world's version of Groundhog Day?
I think Andy Carl.
Danny Rubin plays John Malkovich in.
That's just another facet of the Nancy stepping forward and singing a song called "Playing Nancy" within this story, which the there was this opportunity to reflect on how being in a show and doing the same thing night after night after night and playing the role that you're cast in and not being able to change that role became part of the experience for an opportunity, for a live version of Groundhog Day that doesn't exist on film.
I've got to ask about Seeing You, which may be my favorite song from the musical. And Tim, I know you performed that. Was it at the Olivier's a few years ago?
I think when the first public outing was at the Evening Standard Awards.
Evening Standard Awards, that's it. Yeah, it's on YouTube. Yes. Again, if you're listening to this, go and check it out. It's incredible. There's also some versions of Andy singing it from the Broadway version, which is terrific. But again, that song from the point of view of all three of you, how important was it? I mean, obviously it's the final song of the musical, but nailing it, was it tricky? Tim, it doesn't seem to be too difficult in terms of the genesis of these songs.
Slightly traumatic, but fine. I mean, it's just so much fun trying to solve these problems, and I think I remember the fun of the solution more than I remember the pain of trying to find it.
I remember coming in knowing that I wanted to aim for the ending to be sublime, for it not to be like a big showpiece ending, but for it to be something a little bit more folksy and warm and maybe bittersweet even. And he found the tone. He found it perfectly and almost like a country western song.
Yeah, well, I did like this idea, layers upon layers of ambition, that part of what we're doing in the audience is, I didn't want it to be pastiche, and I hope it's not, but I did want to say we're going to not only represent the stages of life through these repeated days, but we're going to represent them a bit with the sort, the music will reflect in a slightly tropey way. So when he's, being exploitative and just going for sex and drugs, it's very sort of 70s porn. And when when the idea that these two drunken kind of hicks and he together come up with this sort of, oh my God, nothing matters, this song about nihilism, nobody cares, the idea of being completely disempowered in the case of Gus and Ralph, or having literally no tomorrow in the case of Phil, the idea that this should be super fast bluegrass, and then the kind of emo rock, slightly Linkin Park-y period of his life where he wants to suicide, which is, it's very dark humor to anyway, but to add on top of that this sort of very dark humor of that style of music, slightly laughing at it whilst hopefully again having its cake and eat it too. Mm. Anyway, in that mode of thinking about what styles could reflect those different phases of life, I just felt like a sort of rootsy folk is this thing that, I hated in the 90s, but I grew towards the simplicity and peace of rootsy, almost country. It is country, really.
Yeah.
And, brought up in grunge era 90s, I just, I had to grow towards it and to the peace of that. And I just thought that sounds about right.
Ending with a ballad, as Danny said, is an unusual thing to do. Mm. You would normally end with a very big song, and usually involving quite a lot of people. At the end of a musical like that, and so this is slightly upside down. And I remember when we were writing, when we were developing Matilda, and with Tim and Dennis Kelly, and I would often say, we would often say, what we want to do is create something that doesn't drive down the middle of the road, but doesn't fall off the road. And you try to find a place where you can stretch convention and contradict convention without losing an audience. And when I watch the film of Groundhog Day, I see a kind of radical piece of art, actually, and wisdom dressed in wonderful populism. And that contradiction really, really appeals to me. And I think it's one of the things we've tried to do with this is to certainly we have got a show here that is not what you expect if you've just seen and kind of liked the film of Groundhog Day. It's much richer and it is entertaining, and we've tried to make it populist as well, because I believe that, you know, connecting with as many people as possible when you've got something rich is the right thing to do. So it is a very much a Trojan horse type of show. You think it's one thing, you get something, hopefully much, much, much more. The question is, you know, when people don't expect something, will they turn up for it? Yeah. If it's not what they expected. Mm-hmm. But certainly when people go away from the show, we've got away with so many things. We've got away with a 17-minute end of Act One. We've got away with ending the show on a bittersweet, very gentle ballad. And all of these things are kind of rule-breaking while still being in this sort of package of delight and entertainment and populism as well.
And there's even a sequence where Phil commits suicide over and over again on stage.
Right.
Which I thought was incredibly bold when I saw it for the first time.
It is, you know, and that, you know, it's in that particular case, it's definitely Tim saying, creating a sharp edge to something. But I think the thing, not to speak for you, Tim, but, you know, the thing that you've worked out over the years is how far you can take something without losing the audience, right?
Yeah, hopefully. And if you, yeah, certainly in my career, I always think if you're not losing anyone, then you're probably letting down most. You know, if someone's not offended, then everyone else might be feeling a bit beige, you know. So, and if you want, as we do, to send people out of the theatre feeling like they've just had the most amazing meal, you know, like that they've laughed and cried and thought and been a bit shocked and. But you send them out with a big, full heart. That feeling when you walk out of a theatre and you've seen something beautiful that makes you just go, why do I think about all this stupid stuff? I just need to love everyone more and be a kinder person. I mean, that's what art's for, to remind you of your humanity. And I think people, that's all I want them to do. I think they do with Matilda, and I know they do with Groundhog Day. They walk out really full-hearted, and if you don't push anywhere during the journey, that you only get that if you ask something of them on the way. Otherwise it's just Disney, it's just treacle. You gotta push and pull them and make them feel different things to land them in a place of big warm-heartedness. I think
that's the other thing about this, easy to forget about theater at its best is a very celebratory form. And it's full of, you know, joy, capacity to create joy and shared joy, more than cinema, actually. And which is obviously capable of doing joy, but it's ultimately more individualistic and voyeuristic in the way that it's viewed. And that song that we're talking about, Hope, where you point out that there were multiple suicides, Phil trying to kill himself day after day to end it all and failing. So the audience during that number are laughing and applauding. What are they laughing and applauding? Because, well, at the same time as this song's being sung, visually, there's this series of magic illusions where Phil is
astonishing.
Killing himself in one part of the stage, reappearing alive in another part of the stage over again, which is essentially just a celebration of what theatre can do and the celebration of the form
all
as well.
The while deconstructing the fallacy of hope because the song is actually about never giving up hope that he'll successfully die. Yeah. So it's completely brutal. But, you know, it's the stuff of life, man.
It's the stuff of life. Real quick, you know, obviously you guys have just come off Matilda, the movie. Is there a movie version of this?
Oh, my God, that would
could
be
work
meta.
One day? I mean, that would be... Has that been done? The producers did it, I guess.
Yes, there are some shows that have made it. Hairspray's another one.
Hairspray's another one, yeah.
Well, that would be a journey, wouldn't it? No comment at this stage. I will say, though,
one day at a time.
You know, it was a big undertaking doing the film of Matilda. and not least logistically and everything like that, but also because we were carrying something very precious that we cared about and loved. It was working very well in one form and carrying it into another form, trying not to lose its virtues and its the precious things about it, whilst having to change and replace it in order to fit a new form and stuff. So it was quite an interesting endeavor. And I think that if you're almost thinking about bringing the musical Groundhog Day into a film, we'd all go through the same thing. The three of us would be, first of all, gripped with fear, kind of like, well, we don't want to ruin anything. We don't want to mess with anything. It's there's something really working about the stage version.
Groundhog Day film is very, very good. With Matilda, although there was an old version of the story of Matilda on film, it didn't feel like something, you know, it was American. It was a very different thing. We were going to do a very British, very musical version of it. Whereas Groundhog Day, the movie, the musical of the movie feels it feels like a fantastic idea, actually, now that I say it.
Dan, are you up for another crack?
I'm not busy.
Obviously, you're going on tour with the various tours. Mom. Yeah.
Yeah. But
I think you could have another go at it.
Yeah. From your mouth.
And then after that, there would have to be a musical adaptation
of the movie.
And then...
Or a video game. Because it is actually a video game. You get the same scenario and you have to try and master it.
Danny, I want to finish with you because obviously you created Groundhog Day. You came up with the concept. It still astonishes me that this was effectively the first time loop movie, the first time loop anything. Where did that idea first come to you? And it must amaze you where you've ended up.
Oh, no, I always assumed I'd end up somewhere like this.
In the old fic.
When the movie got bought and greenlit and everything, my feeling was, oh, finally, at last. Well, the idea of a guy repeating the same day was part of a brainstorm session and one of a lot of ideas I came up with. But it was later when I was... trying to come up with another movie idea, just sort of brainstorming again a couple of years later, I was thinking about eternity and whether some people who don't ever tend to grow up, maybe they just haven't had enough time. And I started imagining an extra life for them and an eternity and seeing what that would look like. And realizing immediately that was a very cumbersome movie, I remembered the idea of one guy repeating the same day and realized you could have eternity all on the same day. And that's when it became a movie in my head.
Well, speaking of eternity, it's time for lunch. So I'm going to let you guys go. It's been an absolute pleasure. Danny, Tim, Matthew, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that was Danny Rubin, Tim Minchin, and Matthew Warchus. Thanks to Armani from the Old Vic Press Office for making that happen. And thanks to the guys for being so generous with their time. If you haven't seen Groundhog Day, the musical, or you wish to revisit, tickets are on sale at oldvictheatre.com. It plays all the way up to the middle of August. And if you want to listen to the songs, the soundtrack is available, of course. And hey, if you don't wish to see the play, or you can't, well, can I recommend a film for you to see instead? Well, the name escapes me right now. Don't worry, I'll remember it next time. Anyway, that's it from me. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.